Black Narcissus from 1947 has always been one of my favorite kind of hidden gems of a film. It's not like a movie that you can bring up in conversation and a lot of people have seen it.
Regrettably so.
Oh, see, spoiler alert, we really like this movie. But yeah. I will say, you know, I always try and pitch this movie to people. And I was wondering, how would you pitch this to someone? Like, you really got to see this movie. It's about
horny nuns in India.
That's not bad. Hey, I always like to pitch it, at least the 1947 one, as a horror film with nuns.
That would be... All right. So I think that would be... I think a psychological drama about nuns.
Go psychological.
Ahead, I would say it's a psychological drama about the systematic mental breakdowns of angelic sisters who are on a mission in this small village in Nepal.
100% in, but yeah. Replace that with repressed Catholics.
Okay.
And right. I would, that would be like my keywords, repressed Catholic nuns.
I think horny, it really captures all
and horny and horny.
In a very word that will entice people. Titillate, I think is the word, right? It's going to be like, oh, horny nuns you today. Mm-hmm. Now I'm my interest has been piqued.
Yes, and we hope your interest has been piqued. Yes. If you do or you don't know, Black Narcissus was a 1947 categorized as British psychological drama film. And most recently, it has been remade a 2020 BBC miniseries that has recently aired on FX in the USA.
Correct.
So this is what we're going to be talking about this week. And I'm excited because this is definitely one of my favorite films of all time.
For sure. Agreed.
All right. So without further ado, I am Nicole.
And I am Rolando.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast.
About unoriginality. So it is December, a couple more weeks until Christmas.
Can you believe? The year's almost over. 2020, this dumpster fire of a year is finally almost over.
Seriously.
God only knows what 2021 brings. But yeah. Hopefully better things.
I pray better things. Yeah, I keep seeing things on the news about like vaccine trials and someone in England got the first one. And I'm like, oh my gosh, wow. I mean,
I know. We're already at this stage. Then you read the news, it's just like Trump declined ordering an extra 100 million offered by Pfizer. Yes. It's like, oh, that's right. He's still president for a few more weeks.
Six more weeks, yeah. And today.
Six? Oh, that's too long.
Well, today the NHL said they're going to come back on January 13th. So that's some good news.
Oh.
A couple days before your birthday.
Yeah, I'm not a hockey fan.
Oh, yeah.
Or I got my sports watcher in general.
Neither am I. I just like ice hockey because it's cold. But
and violent.
And, ooh, yeah, true.
Yeah.
Eddie Z is with us.
Eddie Z, what's up?
Hey, guys.
And I'm really glad he is because I really can't wait to hear both your thoughts on this piece.
This is the story of a high endeavor that tried and tested a woman in the remote background of Asia. The story of a prince and a beggar maid. And of a nun who gave up her vows.
Why should we want to keep you here against your will? Because you're all jealous of me. Especially you.
The clash of strong personalities.
I understood you wanted to see me.
We want to talk to you on business.
I suppose you want to talk to me on anything else. Sorry.
I don't know why you are being so rude to me, Mr. Dean. I have to talk business with you, whether I like it or not.
The contrast of present peace and self-denial with the rich memories of the full years that have passed. They renounced the world of men, but found that the world was not to be denied.
I gave up my vows. I finished with them up there.
So, like I said, Black Narcissus, 1947, British film. And it's one of my favorites. I am really, really a fan and an admirer of the two writers, producers, and directors, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. Rolando, I know you saw this film in grad school.
I did see this film in grad school.
Yeah, and you liked it from the first watch?
From the first watch, I was very much enamored with it. I got to rewatch it a second time with friends who are not film goers, right? I got to expose it to them. So you know how you ask is just like, oh, how do you pitch this to friends? I've been trying to pitch this movie to them for forever. Now we have an actual weekly meetup where we watch movies together online. And they had no choice because it was my turn. And I pitched this as a Christmas movie because there was a Christmas scene and they are Christians. So
there you go.
And but no, needless to say, though, as expected, they were also very much enamored with this movie because how could you not? There's just like... It's one of those few, this is one of those few movies that when I found out the age, like how old this movie is, I was just like, no way.
Yeah.
No way.
That is how it comes off. Yeah. And I mean, this is just one of many good films by them. I would recommend anything by these filmmakers if you feel so inclined to see more.
What other movies have they made?
Maybe The Red Shoes.
I've never heard of that.
It's a masterpiece of cinema. They made A Matter of Life and Death.
I've heard of that one. I've never seen it.
It's a very good film.
Okay.
The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, another great film. Just Michael Powell made a great film called Peeping Tom, which is kind of like the British equivalent to Psycho.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, really great movies. I know where I'm going.
All these movies sound like Lifetime original movie titles.
They don't insult them. Come on. What are
you the titles?
Just the titles, yeah.
Just the titles. I don't know anything about the premises, but Red Shoes sounds a little Lifetime-y for me.
The Red Shoes is the one I would say, Rolando. That's the one you got
to
see.
All right, fine. I'll be sure to check that one out.
But before you do that, let's just talk a little bit about Black Narcissus. Did you know it was based on a book?
Yes, I did know it was based on a book. I mean, I found that out, I think, in the credits of the first one, right? Based on the book by...
Yeah.
The name escapes me.
Rumor? I'm pretty sure it's Rumor Godin.
Like Rumor Willis?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, a very unique name. Rumor Godin.
I'm assuming they were British?
Yes, she is a British... She's an English woman.
But was she living in India?
She was born in England, but she grew up in colonial India, a part of it, which is now actually Bangladesh. And then she attended school, but then when the First World War began, she came back to what is now Bangladesh. So she went back and forth between England, and I think she finally settled in Calcutta. I think. Don't quote me on that. But so she's very familiar with the experience, and you know,
the life of imperialists.
Well, that's the thing. I don't know if. You know, our listeners might not be aware of this, but, you know, Britain for a long time colonized India. Actually, you know, like, you should probably watch Gandhi. It tells you a lot about that history there.
Yes, that's where you should get all your history lessons from Gandhi.
If you want to watch a movie, you know, that's a good way to sum up the history there. That's
Ben Kingsley, right?
Yeah. I think he won the Oscar for that.
He did. Problematic casting, though, in 2020?
Yeah.
We could have said,
definitely.
Okay.
It's a pretty okay movie. But so, you know, finally, like after many, many years, that has ended. But for a while, that was kind of the thing. And there was a huge class system in India between English people who were colonized there and people who lived there, like on the land, actual Indians.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, isn't Indian, correct me if I'm wrong, but I learned this in school. However, who knows if this is correct anymore, but. I remember learning in, I think, social studies, India has a very classist system, right? Like, they divide people up by class. Caste, I think is what it's called.
A caste system. C-A-S-T. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's influence from there. I mean, I'm not sure. You know, it's not my culture, and I do want to learn a little bit more about it, but that is a very basic thing that we should kind of understand when we're familiarizing ourselves with these properties.
Mm-hmm.
So Black Narcissus was written in 1939. It's only the third book that Rumor Godin wrote, and she's written many, many books. The only thing is that, you know, it's hard to read up on her, right? And it was hard for me to even, like, find anywhere I can see this book. You know, it's not...
Is that in print?
Really, yeah. Not that I'm aware of, but the only thing that I did find out is that she did not like the movie.
But what?
She did not like it. She actually
declared...
What is
up with these authors and hating, like, their film adaptations?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you why she hated it when we talk about the movie, but she did say, you know, I've decided that I'm never going to let anyone... do another one of my books into a film again, but she did like 3 years later.
Speaking of which, though, it's interesting, right? We think of Hollywood being unoriginal all the time, like, and we think it's a new contemporary problem. However, like, it seems that Hollywood has just been ripping off books since the beginning.
Adaptations have been the thing since the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's funny. I feel like that's a conversation I have with friends all the time. It's just like, oh, Hollywood has no original ideas. Hey, this is our podcast.
Absolutely not. No, yeah, exactly. I mean, like, if we were to actually cover, like, Dracula, like, we covered that in a past episode. But, you know, we could have covered Son of Dracula and Bride of Dracula, you know, all the times that Hollywood revived it for a buck.
Right.
So it's definitely, this is nothing new. It's just, we're just tackling it from today's perspective.
That's Dracula was also, for our listeners, another BBC another BBC inspired series that we covered, and I gotta say it left quite a high bar that when I heard BBC was attached to this project, I was very much it was tantalizing. I was just like, oh wow, BBC and Black Narcissism, I have high hopes, and I can't wait for you guys to listen to my thoughts.
Yeah, stay tuned. So this is actually really great. On the Wikipedia page, according to film critic David Thompson, Black Narcissus is that rare thing, an erotic English film about the fantasies of nuns.
Isn't it interesting? Erotic is a word you will hear associated with this word. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
Because this is a film about desire.
Okay.
And actually, this really good article that I read did say something that I'm going to quote from it. There's this Kent Jones article that's in the Criterion slip of this film. There's three E's that we should think about when we think about Black Narcissus: expressionism,
okay,
eroticism, and exoticism.
Well, I mean, the casting was anything. It was far from exotic, but okay.
All right, so let's talk about plot, and then we're going to talk about execution, because sure. I think that's actually something that I really kind of want to focus on.
And I know that you're a fan of this film, as am I. I think we should try to do our best to not gush about this film, because I think it goes without saying this film is a master. I was going to say masterpiece. Would you rank it as that? I think it's a master. It's master filmmaking for sure.
It is, yeah.
And storytelling. So I don't want to gush about this, because I think we could be objective about this film still.
I agree with you.
This is one of those rare instances where I have also seen like the original one, and I have like such a high esteem for it. True. Right? I always usually see the opposite.
Okay. All right. So let's try and play devil's advocate. Okay. Then.
Yeah. Or if not, I'll play devil's advocate if I must.
Okay. All right, we'll see.
You could be Sister Clouda. I'm going to tempt you.
You're going to be the Mr. Dean to my Sister Clouda?
Exactly. Perfect.
That's really nice. Okay, so a mission of Anglican nuns from the Order of the Servants of Mary are sent to a remote former brothel of a palace to set up a missionary there, essentially.
Yes, it's a palace that's also a former whorehouse.
Yes, and then it is in the middle of India, in colonial India, near Darjeeling. This is location-wise. It's in the middle of the Himalayas.
They could have renamed this movie The Best Little Whorehouse in Mobile.
In Darjeeling. The Best Little Whorehouse in the Himalayas. That's great.
Yes, perfect. Oh, and you have like your alliteration there.
Yes. So it is led by a very young head nun. What's the term? I'm sorry, for head
mother
nuns.
Superior.
Sister Superior. Thank you.
Is it Sister Superior or Mother? It could be either. Superior. Sister, okay, Mother. Oh, Sister Superior.
Sister Superior, who is Sister Clouda, played by Deborah Kerr, which is also, we talked about Deborah Kerr very recently when we did The Innocence and Haunting of Bly Manor. So here she is again.
Deborah Kerr? That was Deborah Kerr?
That was Deborah Kerr.
Wait, but we've done something else with Deborah Kerr in it, right?
An Affair to Remember.
Okay, perfect. I was about to say, I totally forgot that she was in Blind Manor.
Innocence,
right.
Yeah, two completely different roles, but you
know. Two very, very different. Actually, the sexual deviancy seems something that she enjoys.
The repression is there.
Yes.
Well, she is Irish, I'm sure. So, but anyway, so it's Sister Clouda, and she is Sister Superior, and she comes with Sister Philippa because Sister Dorothea tells her, bring Sister Philippa for the garden, Sister Bryony for the infirmary, Sister Blanche, or as they call her, Sister Honey, for the children, right? Because she's very like motherly. And then we kind of want Sister Ruth off our hands so you could take her too.
Yeah, what a
really what they say.
What a move. I haven't we all done that with a friend, right? It's just like, I don't want to deal with this person.
I'm just going to load her onto you. Yeah.
Exactly. When you're doing like a car trip, right? It's just like, I can't just go with them.
I'm going to remember that next time we're in a trip.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Whoever I ask is just like, you want to come? That's how you know where you rank in my friendship.
This is true. So the five of them go, and they are kind of aided by a man who lives remotely in this area. Like, literally, they're their palace, now their school is all the way on the top of the mountains. He's all the way at the bottom, and his name is Mr. Dean. He is very skeptical. He likes to drink. He's very in tune with the earth, and he's not very religious. So he's kind of like the antagonist for them in some ways.
A foil.
But they rely on him very much. You know, he is someone that they need.
I know, right? Talk about like not being independent women.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. So anyway, he makes a prediction that when they come, that he's like, I don't think you guys are going to last here. There was a bunch of, you know, there were men priests here before you guys.
No, they were monks.
They were monks. The monks that they left and they abandoned this. And I predict you're going to leave before the next monsoon comes. So he almost kind of gives them a foreboding warning.
A harbinger of doom.
And essentially what happens in the film is the area, right? The palace, but more so just the place itself starts to kind of haunt them, and it affects them, and it affects who they are as human beings more right. so than who they are as nuns.
Correct.
And they kind of just start to lose themselves. Sister Philippa, she forgets to answer to her, the bell, and she's growing all these beautiful things to the point where she feels like she can't even live there anymore. So she has to be transferred. Sister Honey gets so taken with the children that she accidentally, spoiler alert, due to caring so much about them, she actually accidentally kills one of them.
That's okay. So the kid, there was
the kid was always going to die.
Right. There was nothing she could have done.
And it was castor oil that she gave.
Yeah. She didn't help him.
She didn't help him. It was just like
the impression that she would, and she didn't deliver.
The guilt.
Yeah.
The guilt that she experienced.
Yes.
And the person who, and even Sister Clodagh, the main character, you know, Sister Superior herself, is starting to remember why she became a nun and a past love of hers and the heartbreak that she faced there.
Isn't that always the case? Don't we all join
it's a always non, a boy,
nunnery
yeah.
or priesthood because of our broken hearts?
Well, back in the day too, a lot of women kind of like that was one of their only options.
Oh.
You know, you had, what kind of life were you going to lead if you were, you know, like... made pregnant and you didn't have a husband? That was like very shameful life to lead. Right. So she kind of felt like she had no option. The person though that their surroundings is kind of affecting the most seems to be the emotionally unwell Sister Ruth.
Sister Ruth.
Who in this film is played by Kathleen Byron.
Uh-huh.
Played to absolute excellence by Kathleen Byron.
Oh yeah, let's talk. I mean, she...
So wonderfully played.
Crazy. Just shines from her eyes.
So, you know? What do you think about the character of Sister Ruth? Do you think she's actually crazy? Do you think that she just became, you know, kind of like the surroundings made her realize that maybe being a nun isn't all it's cracked up to be? And blah,
Eddie,
blah, blah.
I want to let Eddie answer this one because I think he kind of may have opened my eyes to what was going on with her. Eddie.
Yeah, lay it on me.
No, I really thought I that she had... a mental illness that wasn't diagnosed or being treated, and being in that particular environment amplified her symptoms to an episode. You know, it just led to an episode that it's done so much better in the remake. But for this is just a constant, the constant paranoia. And the storytelling that goes on in her head of what's going on with her and the other sisters. Like how they, like her story is they hate her, you know, Mr. Dean is falling in love with me and Sister Superior is trying to steal Mr. Dean from me. Like all these stories are going on in her head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Eddie made that argument to me, and I actually, watching it the second time, I actually agree with him. I think this is a form, she did have maybe a form of mental illness, probably bipolarism.
Yeah.
Is what I'm thinking.
Or even schizophrenia, perhaps, you know, that paranoia.
Schizophrenia.
Yeah, maybe. I think that's more prevalent though in the remake. Schizophrenia seems more likely for the remake. In this one, I would have to make the argument it's probably bipolar because we don't actually have her interacting with voices, you know what I mean? Although schizophrenia has paranoia, right?
Yeah, that's a big thing of schizophrenia.
Okay. So maybe paranoia. Maybe schizophrenia. So, but I actually, right? So, but prior to this explanation from Eddie, I was just under the impression that she was just, you know.
Cray-cray.
Not just cray-cray, but like just really, really wanting some D, right? Like she, her attachment to Mr. Dean is tragic at the end, right? Especially when she's confessing her love and he's just like, I don't, have we even talked?
Yeah.
He's very confused by her emotions. And he, oh my God, when she's just like, but you said this to me the first time we met. He's like, I say that to everybody. You're nothing. You're not special.
Yeah. I love no one. Yeah.
She went crazy. And
she did.
It was the first read, right? That was my first initial read. It was just like she was, it was a heartbreak and stuff. And obviously the solitude just drives you to madness.
Yes. And that's, I definitely think, you know, you guys hit it on the nail, is that she was emotionally unwell and that this was the, probably the worst environment for her.
Right.
And Sister Clota saw it happening, you know, that you could see almost like they were scared of her. They didn't know how to handle her. They didn't know how to talk to her.
Oh, poor Eric Joseph Anthony?
Joseph Anthony.
Yeah. He was so terrified of her.
Yeah.
He would bring her the milk. And he's just like placing it on the table, like stretching out his hand. Like.
Yeah. And she wasn't a very kind person. She was very rude to the children. She spoke of them incredibly disrespectfully. So, you know, she probably was bipolar depressed because at the end of the day, she was kind of a selfish piece of shit. When you're depressed, you can't help but be self-absorbed and whatnot. Not, you know, you're very consumed with your emotions.
Fair.
And that is what Sister Ruth was. And she definitely, the person who she kind of targets is Sister Clota.
Right.
And like you said, she thinks that Sister Clota is trying to keep Mr. Dean from her. So then we go back to Sister Clota in this particular piece. Do you think that Sister Clota had some sort of feelings for Mr. Dean and that she was coming to terms with her own repression?
Yeah.
I think
absolutely she was definitely struggling with. I don't know. I think for the movie, this is more about. I made the joke that it's about horny nuns. I don't think it's necessarily just about horny nuns, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she's attracted to Mr. Dean because he is a handsome man.
Yeah.
And like they have a nice rapport. And you know, they challenge each other, right? And I think sometimes you want that in a partner. You want a partner who can challenge you, and they challenge each other.
Yeah.
I think it's the loneliness up there that really is what kind of makes her see comfort in Mr. Dean.
Definitely.
And it awakens all these feelings from her past. I think that's the one thing that is said early in this film, that there's the ghosts of the past come and haunt you here, right? This is like a basically it's in its own weird way like a ghost story.
Mm-hmm.
Besides the fact that there's no real supernatural elements, these are, remember when we were talking about Mandalay Bay, right? The ghosts are in our head. This is what this movie is about. The ghosts are in
Mandalay
our head.
Mandalay Bay, yeah.
Uh-huh. Whoa, yeah. Mandalay Bay sounds like, that's not it. Mandalay Manor?
Mandalay Mansion, yeah.
A mansion.
Absolutely. You know, doing some readings about this film, because it's, you could really like go down the rabbit hole when it's like, well, what is this film about? What are they trying to say? And one of the more interesting things that I read actually was someone who was like, this film is about people who are trying to create their own ideal way, state of living, but have to come to terms with reality. And you know, Deborah Kerr, right, she has to come to terms with why she became a nun and all the things that she hasn't even thought about in the middle of like staring over at those mountains, feeling the wind in her face, right? All of them, they all come to terms with things about themselves that they don't want to, some uglier than others and some not as big. But that's the thing too, is that you can't kind of like deny reality, if that makes sense. Which is what they kind of were trying to do up until the movie began, right? Before they were assigned to this mission. Because that's also, you have to, when you give your life to God in such a way that an Anglican nun does, you don't ever really think about what it is to like live in the earth. You think about just the, like your devotion to God.
Your servitude.
Your servitude and whatnot.
Right.
So it's just kind of like, what happens when you are stuck in like the worst environment you possibly can, with a breathtaking view, with wind, with all this stuff. And then also, you're also in a completely different land that is not your home.
Wind, for sure, here is something that's important in the movie. Just like in terms of sound design, like you're just constantly hearing the wind or the wind chimes in the background.
Yes, you are.
At any given point in the movie. And I think that's also part of the thing that just drives... I'm not saying necessarily driving them crazy, but like it's again this like kind of feeling of eeriness.
Yeah.
It's like otherworldly.
That's, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And there's other people who live with them there, you know, like they have the woman who helps them, Angu.
Yes, who is easily one of the best characters.
Yes, played by Mae Hallett, a white woman.
Yeah, I was, all right, so I will admit this. I didn't realize, I thought in the first time I saw this movie, I didn't get her name. I thought she was just like a colonist who really adapted to like Indian life, and she was just like the caretaker. So I thought she was supposed to be an English woman who's just kind of like mad, and then it's just like the second watch, you're like, oh wait, no, she's playing an Indian.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They didn't, at least, well, they didn't put brown face on her. She's one of the women they didn't put brown face
on. They did put it on Gene Simmons for Kenshi.
Yeah. I guess that's where she drew the line in her performance. She's just like, I don't have to wear brown face. I'll just go over the top.
Yeah.
And over the top she did. But my God, is she such a memorable character.
Yeah, she is. It's a good performance. It's enjoyable.
It is. It is a great performance.
She breaks the tension.
She does.
Yes,
it does. It does. She has very, very comical elements about her.
100%.
That kind of like throws off the very seriousness of the sisters. You know, they're very proper English seriousness compared to her, like, you know, like her coming in and making noises and having these kind of like
all
remarks.
Her characteristics, yeah.
And just like taking some glee when the sisters fall flat on their faces.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, because they all know what they all know the reality of the situation, right? They're almost just waiting for these sisters to crumble,
right?
And Joseph Anthony's another one who is kind of like not even comedic, but just kind of like puts a smile on your face.
Oh, he's
you know,
so
breaks
adorable.
The tension. Yeah,
he's so adorable.
And so and Kenshi and the young general played by Sabu.
Yes,
who are different? They're a subplot. Which is that Sabu is the young general who comes at behest of the general to learn before he goes off to college in England a little bit more with the nuns. But while he is there, he is, of course, taken with a young girl who is there, probably like just a teenager named Kenshi, who is brought there by Mr. Dean.
So let's talk about this, right?
Yeah.
It's implied that Mr. Dean and her had a thing, right?
No, it's not implied. I would say that he's assuming that other people think.
That's fair.
Assume that that's the kind of man he is.
And that that's the kind of life that this woman has. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I was both times I read this, watched the movie, I was like, because he makes it a point to ask Sister Clota, is just like, is there something you want to ask me about her?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when she kind of flips out. She's just like, you speak too familiar with me.
Yeah, but he's also just 100% antagonizing her, even if he's sure or not.
Yeah, tease.
Do you think, all right, and this is only, I only bring this up because when I watched this movie, one of my friends brought this up, and I think it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that he was having his way with his natives? Not necessarily having his way, but like he was definitely banging his way through the area.
Yeah, probably. I'm sure he, you know, definitely tipped well.
I guess what kind of tip we talking about, right?
No, I'm sure. I mean, he lives in solitude.
Mm-hmm.
Of course he's going to pay for the, you know, company of a person. I mean, okay. We don't know. He seems like he could be sexually open.
I don't think that he would have to pay.
He might not have to.
From my experience in speaking with missionaries and talking to religious people that have been on missions, something, especially if you're like light skin or blue eyes or blonde hair, there's an attraction.
Is it like you're the exotic
native
one?
Yeah, you're the exotic one. And there's like this, like, you know, this like, yeah, there's an attraction that you bring.
Yeah.
You know? So Mr. Dean can be that.
Yeah. Yeah, and he seems to have some sort of respect in the area. They come to him, and he's very well aware of all of them. And so there definitely is, there's this aura about this guy, right? Mr. Dean, sure. Everyone loves him. What do you guys love him?
I liked him.
I did. I was just so I think his thing was like, he would always be in various stages of undress.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And him walking around with his chancletas.
Yep. And those shorts on his mule.
The short shorts. Just
those
like...
short shorts.
Yeah. And I love that they gave him a mule. That's my favorite thing. He looks so odd riding that mule.
It is. It's actually, it's a great comedic effect because he's a tall guy. He has like these
he's very
long
tall, yeah.
legs, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, why even bother riding the mule? But it works. It's a great comedic effect.
It does.
It makes him more likable in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? Yeah, kind of. I mean, so in this film, I will say that I particularly don't, I've never read too much of a relationship that was stirring underneath between Mr. Dean and Sister Clodagh.
How?
I've always felt that the only thing that was being ignited between the two of them was her past and everything that she's repressed. And that he brought it out in her, but I don't think she particularly looked at him and was like, oh, Mr. Dean, hello. I think that there was a weird sort of friendship.
Uh-huh.
But I won't say that there was anything in this version romantic for me.
All right, I will say this. I think Deborah Kerr is a wonderful actress in this movie because she's able to convey. So I was able to read every time they were in they had scenes together. There was like this sexual energy.
Okay.
This charged up sexual energy. And it could be coming from Mr. Dean himself, right? Because he, in a way, he's playing like a very sexual character, right? Like Eddie mentioned, he's in various states of undress. He's like kind of very, he's handsome. He's a handsome guy.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when you're a nun and you probably smell him and you see him, of course, it's going to get you a little flustered, but I don't know.
I think
she's making so much assumptions.
But again, this is where I think it was that challenging that was like he was always challenging her and she was always challenging him. And there was definitely a thing there. I think this is where Deborah Kerr's acting comes in, right? She's so great at kind of giving you that like, oh, she just had resting bitch face throughout most of the movie, and yet with ever so subtle looks, you could convey that look of just like, oh, if I wasn't married to God right now, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Maybe it's just me reading it to it, but I don't know, Eddie. What did you think? Because apparently Nicole didn't. I'm surprised. Did you? Did you not think there was anything going on with them?
I did feel there was a tension between them, and I think her attraction was what probably ignited those feelings. The last connection, the primary connection that she had of her first love, or the love that broke her heart that led her into the nunnery.
Right.
You know, just kind of like bringing back, you know, those memories. And her I think also point of her re-exploring those memories too.
So this is one of the cardinal sins, right? Lust is one of the cardinal sins. Do you know what the other sin that she is kind of like living through?
Pride.
Pride, yeah. Like she, that would, I would say that the sexual repression for sure is one of her arcs, but like her pride is the thing that really is the biggest monster in her life.
Yeah, no, definitely.
And I think the movie does such a great job of kind of really from the get-go making a point, making it stand out. You know, the mother superior, right, her boss, is just like, I don't think you're right for the job. I think you're too young. And now she has like an agenda, right, to prove her wrong, to prove everyone wrong.
Yeah.
And she's putting like her role as the mother superior. Sister superior. When she's doing that, she's putting other people's lives at risk.
Yeah, she kind of is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that her pride is probably the most, the biggest thing that I'm getting from her as for her version of Sister Clodagh.
Mm.
I think her pride is too strong for her to kind of reveal anything else about herself. For me, at least, which I mean, I won't deny that there is some sort of tension, but I didn't see it as anything more as that. I just saw it as more so like her just dealing with her past and things that she hadn't thought about in a long time, but not really about him.
But the reason, so, and I think this also goes to Sister Philippa, right? When she says like, there are some things I haven't thought about for 21 years. Well, what was it? Girl, you're thinking of your nether regions. I think there was... So I actually think this is why the setting is important, right? The fact that this is a whorehouse. I think it's that sexual charge. Like, you know, there was like a scene where they had the tapestry that they cover up, mm-hmm. or the mural of, mm-hmm. like, you know, all the women doing their whorish things all in right, the palace.
But it's not whorish. It was a house for women, and they were mostly the concubines.
Concubines aren't whores? No, they're what's a concubine? I don't know what a concubine is.
It's a mistress.
Oh, I don't. Okay, fine. Tomato, tomato. You know
that word. Mistress isn't a whore.
I don't know. Okay, agree to disagree, I guess.
And I a whore is a very bad term, but
fine.
but yeah, no. I mean, you're right. I don't know if I thought about Sister Philippa, you know, thinking about her nether regions.
That's what I genuinely, when she said that line, I was just like, oh yeah, I get it. Like, you haven't thought about your lady parts in a while. You're seeing probably all these like sexually explicit scenes like all around the building and stuff, and you know, it makes you think.
I mean, it could be. That's actually not a terrible read. I myself didn't get that from it, but what about Sister Honey though? You know, like, do you think all of them were kind of befalling to this, or
no? I actually don't think they were all falling to me. In fact, Sister Briony, she was probably like the one who probably should have been the Sister Superior, to be honest. Right?
Yeah, seriously,
she held it together throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
No, Sister Honey, I don't think she didn't fall to her
desires.
Yeah, her desires. Thank you. I was trying to find the right word.
Maybe her motherly desire.
There you go. That's exactly what I was going to. Yes. Yeah. I would make that argument. Like, I think if anything, now I'm thinking this is kind of maybe a sexist movie, because it's kind of showing women almost as weak and like kind of giving into their most primal desires, which is apparently
it's showing women as human.
Yes.
Okay. Fine.
But also
fair.
Not even to say women. We're talking about
nuns.
The spiritual struggle of religious missionaries. Okay, and I think more to say, because we start out already knowing that the monks didn't last.
Right.
Yeah. So the guys got there and didn't last long. Yes. They gone. Okay. So it's not about men or women. Okay. But it's about the work that they undertook and the way they did it, too. I saw this movie because it was part of my spiritual education when I was being mentored. And I was working at a church, and the pastor there and a good friend of mine's now, he showed me this movie, and our conversation had to do with missionary work during that time period. And how missionaries at the time may come in with a certain kind of like mentality and disconnect on the people that they're serving, they're supposed to serve.
Yeah.
Too. So when you look on the people as savages, you limit the grace that they have to offer. So they couldn't see that the holiest person among them was the holy man who was sitting cross-legged midway down the mountain, which everybody was going to, okay, mm-hmm. who stood quiet, and everybody felt spiritually fulfilled being around him. But not the sisters,
yeah,
who were supposed to be bringing Christ, the Son of God. You know, they weren't the ones people were going to. The people were only going because the general was giving them money.
That's
another element too. Yeah. So, yeah. You know,
and then his son, you know, he couldn't even just like deny his own human desire, and he ran away with Kanchi. You know, these are things I feel like too. You kind of can't run from your human characteristics, right? Desire is a very primal feeling that people have.
Yeah,
and it's something that like you can try, but in the end, it kind of shows up in the weirdest and sometimes scary ways, as in Sister Ruth's case, even though she was more so unstable. But
which brings up the point, which we're kind of like, we haven't gotten to like the main, I think like some of the best parts of the movie is Ruth's descent into madness and ultimately what happened, like her fate, how the movie ends.
Yes, it has one of the best climaxes of a film, I think, ever.
Ooh.
I showed this film to my girlfriend over there, the the summer because she's a big horror film fan. So I told her, I'm like, you want to see a horror film about nuns? So I showed her Black Narcissus.
I don't, that's such a bad way to get this movie, but okay.
But that was how I trapped her into watching this movie.
Fair enough, fair enough. It's a good movie. I mean, any way to trap people to watch it, I guess is fair.
Yeah, because a 1947 film, a British film about nuns, come on.
I know.
You think people are going to say, yeah, let's watch it. It's a hard sell. So anyway, so literally the climax, she was on the edge of her seat the whole time. And this is where I want to talk about Jack Cardiff, who is the cinematographer for this film.
Okay, let's talk.
He's probably one of the best cinematographers ever. I think his use of shadow and color in particular are breathtaking. Now, there's something really, really interesting about this film, which leads to the aesthetic of it, which is that this film was not shot on location. This film, Michael Powell and Pressburger decided they wanted to shoot it entirely in England to control it more. You know, if they went to India, one, you could ruin half of your footage in transit, you know? Like, that happened to a Nicholas Ray film in the 50s. He did a pricey shoot on location, and then half of it got damaged when they brought it back to the States.
Serves him right.
Seriously, well, back then it was really hard. So they're like, we can't do that. And we, you know, the wind, all these things, we want to control that. We want it to, you know, breeze when we say fucking breeze, right?
Right.
So got to do that in a studio. But because of that, this film almost has kind of like an artifice to it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, one of the best scenes is when she goes to the bell and she looks down the mountain for the first time and she rings. And you may know this because you studied it in grad school.
Yeah.
But something that I want to point out to the listeners is that if you really look closely at that image, you can see that half of it gets cut off. And this, some of it was shot on a set. But then the rest of it is actually a painting that was painted by Jack Cardiff himself. And that
I didn't know.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no. I think I remember that. Yes, yes, yes.
And that half of the film that shows you their surroundings, they're actually paintings, which is why when we said it was three E's and one of them was expressionism, you know, too. Like, this is almost kind of like, because expressionism isn't a reality, it's a version, your mind's version of reality, how you look at the world, right? So this is how the nuns are almost looking at it, and you can even read it as such. You know, the nuns almost look at it as this made up beautiful artistic place,
right?
So
good point.
It comes off almost like unreal, which is what's so great about this film. And the entire climax, going back to that, it feels like a horror film. All of a sudden the film shifts gears and Sister Clodagh is being preyed upon by Kathleen Briney. And it takes its time. It's like a beautiful 5 to 8 minute sequence where Deborah Kerr, her character, Sister Clodagh, decides that it's time for her to ring the bells. And Sister Ruth is just kind of like following her, you know, getting from this staircase to that one, getting on all these different angles to like see which way is the best to pounce on her, because her intent is to throw her off of the mountain. Right.
Which is interesting, right? That's where it went, because my friends, when they were watching it, they thought she was going to straight up commit suicide, right? They thought it was going to go suicide. They thought it was going to go homicide, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, good. You didn't. You were expecting something that I guess you, right, as film goers, you would expect. This is where it goes. It's like,
yeah,
when her heart breaks, what's the next thing to do? All right, narratively speaking, probably kill herself.
Yeah.
Like, we know where it's going to happen. But instead, they went the way of like, I'm going to kill this nun.
And not only that, but like the makeup also leads it to being like, she looks fucking crazy. They give her this really, really unique shade of red lipstick, and then like,
and then she had also her eyes.
Yeah, red under her eyes.
Yeah.
So everything just kind of like is very enhanced. And it's, I mean, I know we said we were going to praise the film, but I'd have to praise the climax because it's just so well done.
We can praise for sure the technical aspects of this film, and I think they're worthy of praise. But I think back to you before this scene, one of my favorite scenes is this shot where you have Sister Ruth in her red gown putting on lipstick, and opposite her, you have Sister Clodagh in her white nun outfit.
Habit.
In her white habit, as she, you know, you see like the dichotomy here, right? You see the juxtaposition. And in a way, I think I love this part too, because Sister Clodagh is almost seeing like almost a mirror image of her, right? Of the life she could have potentially had if, if she had stayed with her true love, if he hadn't left her.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Wow. That's a good read too.
Uh-huh. And that was all me. That was in grad school. That's me and my second watch.
Nice. But did you know that actually this film was released only a few months before India achieved independence from Britain?
No, I did not know that. That's interesting.
And so time-wise, you know, this film in terms of 2020 standings and political correctness, it's kind of offensive. A lot of the natives there are not played by people of the Indian background. They are white people.
Uh-huh.
Some of them with painted on faces, some of them not.
Yes. Or I think I saw a lot of... Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
And, you know, I'm not highly aware of whether or not, you know, it was like commonplace for a Indian person to be cast in a movie or not, but like, it's still not
1940,
right.
I have to assume probably not.
I would have to assume not. But, you know, one could defend Michael Powell and say, well, that just was added to the level of artifice. But I'm not going to do that. I just think that it was just a common thing that people did back then where you gave a job to a white person.
Yeah, this movie is a product of its time.
Yeah.
I think in spite of those flaws, and I think they are fair flaws to call out, I think it's a spectacular, wonderful film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I appreciate about this movie is that there is a lot that you can discuss after you watch it.
100%. Yeah. And it leaves enough for it to be debatable and for mm-hmm. you to say like, oh, you know, well, I think it was more about this. I think it was more about that. So as proven in the first half of this episode.
Yes. But now let's talk about the 3-part miniseries from the BBC that's airing here on FX in the US. Black Narcissus.
Yes.
Mopoo is a wild place.
You shouldn't have come here. A place where time doesn't even exist.
I never liked this palace.
My father used to allow some bad goings on here.
I think this place is too much for all of us. It's as though the mountains are watching us.
The devil comes in many disguises, Sister Blanche.
This is an unusual place, and we should expect unusual things.
There's some films that you kind of, if you're going to remake it and redo it, you're going to live in the shadow of the one that came before you. And that, to me, is 100% the case with this one.
Yes.
Now, if you know Black Narcissus, it lives in the shadow. Because if you know it, you've seen it. So if you're unfamiliar, then this is going to be a brand new thing for you.
Sure. I will just say this before you go. I agree with you.
Uh-huh.
If it was a film-to-film adaptation, when it's a film and it's being adapted as a TV show, I'm going to give it, not leeway, I'm going to actually probably be extra critical, right? Because that gives you the opportunity to give more life to the story. You can take your time with it ever so slightly, and it kind of, I don't know, I feel like it raises the bar a little, because a remake from movie to movie is, what's it called? Yeah, you're going to live under that shadow. I think when you're going to the TV show route,
yeah,
it kind of makes it a little more, it's just like, okay, you have a lot more to live up now, too.
Well, aesthetically, it lives in the shadow of the brilliant film work by these guys, and I do think that this miniseries kind of was well aware of it, and they did a lot of homages to it.
I agree.
There are some scenes that I'm like, oh, that's pretty much like, that's a tribute mm-hmm. to Jack Cardiff and all this stuff. So
I have an interesting question for you.
Yeah.
And this goes into filmmaking and stuff. But I have like this implicit bias against digital film in terms of like movies. However, when it comes to TV shows, I usually lose that bias. I usually am okay with seeing digital. I don't know why. It's like a code switch or something in my head. I don't know. Do you have that experience? I thought this was a beautifully shot show. I actually thought this was actually well done. And you can tell it's digital.
Yeah. No, you can 100% tell it's digital.
But I thought it was better executed than like Rebecca.
Yes, I do too. To answer your question, I'm going to say that I just don't particularly enjoy watching digital things as much as I like watching film. And you know, think about the Twilight Zone, those early episodes are all shot on film. You know, so just because it's on TV, you know, back in the day they shot on film. Film has just completely gone out of fashion. Yeah, back in the day. But like I guess it bothers me. I expect it more from TV. But I mean, nowadays it's a given with cinema anyway, you know, and it's Tarantino says it's not cinema, it's television in public. But then in COVID, there is no such thing as public. So
that's also true.
But anywho, this film is definitely, I think that they kind of also knew that if they were going to set a film in the Himalayas in the 40s, they had to, you know, they had to kind of like bend over to the digital world.
Oh, I mean, yeah, things. That was one of my that was going to be one of my concerns when I was watching this. I was just like, oh, how over-reliant are they going to be with the CGI? And I would say, I don't know, how over-reliant do you think they were with the CGI?
Not as much as I thought they'd be. Yeah, I will say that.
That was my response too. I thought for me, in terms of visually, I was just like, oh, there. You can tell when they're real sets, and you can tell like similar to my biggest concern was how are they going to do those over the bird's eye views of like, you know, the bell tower, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did it well. Like one of those things where you are using CGI to enhance, not create.
That's true, yeah.
And it shows. So I will applaud the show for visually. I think visually it was actually a high caliber show that I was a little taken back at times by. It was like, this visually looks great.
Yeah, I would agree too.
That's about the only praise I have for the show.
So we didn't read the book, so we can't say whether or not this is something that was in the book or not, but the miniseries begins differently from the film. It sets up kind of this interesting backstory where in this miniseries, it was not simply a brothel that used to exist within the walls of the Mopu. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's called Mopu.
Mopu. I think I said Mobu.
You might have said Mopu. It's Mopu. It's, you know, you only got one letter wrong. Right. So this palace, the old general, this is where he kept his women, essentially.
Including his sister, right?
Was it his sister?
Yeah, because that's in this one, the general is not his son, it's his nephew.
Princess Srimati? Was that her name?
Yes, that's her name.
Srimati? So it was his sister.
That was the general's sister.
So then who was she banging?
I don't know.
So, okay. Oh my God, I just watched this and I can't remember.
No, I don't. Terrible. It was one of those things. It could have actually been the Holy Man because the Holy Man was the general's brother. So maybe it was like sister-in-law.
Okay.
I'm not 100% sure. But in this one, it's not the general's son. It's the general's nephew.
Well, so there was a woman who lived when this palace Mopu was inhabited by all the women or, you know, relatives of the fucking general. One of them, Princess
Concubines.
Concubines.
They were definitely called concubines in this one.
Princess Srimati, in a moment of disarray and of sadness, decides to kill herself.
Correct.
And that is how the miniseries begins.
She had a baby.
She had a baby. And right. She just suddenly feels motivated to go to the bell tower and to jump off.
I mean, who wouldn't with that view?
I would never. I would never go near that bell.
I would die, I feel like, if you took me there.
Every step I would take up to that bell, I would like probably pass out. Severe fear of heights like that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, and then, you know, then we're cut to her being assigned to this job. The Covenant of Saint Faith.
Played the sister Dorothea here is played by the
late Diana Rigg.
So this is her last role, I guess. I thought it was going to be Game of Thrones.
Yeah. One of her last.
Oh, you think there's more that they're saving up?
I just can't say for certain it is her absolute last.
I mean, yeah.
But yeah, good cast. I mean, yeah, like Diana Rigg, Jim Broadbent is in a couple of scenes as Father Roberts, but the main sisters, Patsy Farran as Sister Blanche. Rosie Cavallario as Sister Bryony. We have a Sister Adela who comes in a little later.
It's the third episode.
Gina McKee. Sister Ruth. Very interesting name. Aisling Francosi.
Never heard of her.
Francosi, sorry.
Uh-huh. The main cast, I never had seen in anything. I don't know about you.
The only one I kind of knew was Gemma Arterton as Sister Clodagh. You don't know Gemma Arterton?
What do you know her in?
Well, so it was more so Jenny who reminded me that she was in... Oh, God, I forgot it. I'm trying to figure it out. See, yeah.
You lied to me. You don't know who she is. Jenny
reminded me. I know she was in a Quantum of Solace, but...
Oh, okay.
But anyway, and then Alessandro Nivola is Mr. Dean. So this is the cast. Three parts miniseries, which were all directed by Charlotte Bruce Christensen, who is a cinematographer. This is, I think, her first hand at directing.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And they were all written by Amanda Coe. So they were all written and directed by women.
Oh, that I didn't know.
Yeah, well, which is why this film kind of feels differently in the way that they want to portray women.
Okay, interesting. That is not gonna affect my opinion of this project here.
Well, I will say emphasis on want to, whether or not they succeeded is, you know, to be determined.
Uh-huh.
So the plot doesn't really change much other than this element of Princess Srimati. And this film goes as far to suggest that there might be an actual haunting happening within the walls of Mopu.
There is an implication.
I would actually say it's more than an implication. They fucking downright visually tell you every time they look in the mirror, at least Sister Ruth does.
Disagree.
It's just only with Sister Ruth, though.
Sister Ruth.
I think it's... This is why I made the argument. I think this one is more schizophrenic than it is her... than it is, like, bipolarism.
Okay. So, do you think that she was a figment of her imagination, is what you think?
Yes, I think she was, it's one of those situations where, like, she's hearing all these, like, stories and, like, kind of filling in her own gaps and stuff, and she's imagining this in her own head.
I see.
And then the caretaker, Anju, she's not helping the situation either.
Yeah.
But then again, there was also that weird part, though, where, like, at the end of the first episode where the person comes in all bleeding, and she's like, I see her. And then Anju is just like, oh, it has started. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was going to be like, oh, okay, I guess now they are going to. So yeah, I thought it was going to be super, I don't know, a little, this
well,
was a little bit
thing.
Of a mess.
I think it wants it, the implication is that it could be, it couldn't be, mm-hmm. you know, but they definitely kind of embrace the whole like ghost thing a little bit with it. At least to the point where they want you to consider it.
Yes, agreed.
Anju does leave Melk out and whatnot. But so that's the only element that's different. Although I will say that there are a lot of things that are amplified in this version.
Yeah.
For instance, desire. I think that whereas there it's somewhat like, at least if it was there, the relationship and the sexual tension between Mr. Dean and Sister Clodagh in the original, it was a little bit more subtle. It is.
Oh, it was way more subtle. Yeah.
Not subtle at all. This and miniseries.
The 1947 version actually is kind of helped by the Hays Code, because the Hays Code would not allow nuns to like kind of go wayward in their ways on film. And they've talked about this in terms of the making of the movie. This is why they could not like make it explicit that there was an actual sexual desire, which is why I think some people do read into it. I'm one of the people who does read into this. In this one, they kind of were going, just showing you full on straight up, they are down to clown.
Yeah.
You know, both Mr. Dean and her. And I don't blame her for kind of lusting after Mr. Dean, because I think this Mr. Dean, I don't know if this was intentional in the show, but when you first see him, he's not that attractive. But by the end of the show, he's pretty fucking hot, I think. And I don't know what they were doing. I think it was like camera trickery here, where they intentionally made you like not find him sexually attractive at first. And then like by the end of it, you're just like, oh, he is so hot and charming. And I think it's like one of those things where, like, you know, when you're stuck with someone for such a long time, all of a sudden you start seeing
them
in a different way.
Yeah, you start seeing them differently.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I'm hoping that was intentional. And it's not just me crazy. No, but Eddie, you said you saw it too, right? I'm not being cray.
I did see that. There's an element of appeal as the show progresses.
Well, he's also was played very differently. Acting wise, you know, this is definitely, it's either, I don't know if it's the directing or the acting choice, but he was a lot more brutish in the original film. And in this one, he's gentler.
A lot more.
And he's,
I think he still challenges Sister Clodagh in a way, though, that like you see the same dynamic being played out.
Yeah.
Just in a different manner. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So you almost kind of also see what they like in each other a little bit more in this one. Whereas it was simply, he was a man, she was a woman in the original.
He was a boy, she was a girl.
Yeah.
Can I make it any more obvious? In this one, it's more like, yeah, I'm going to make it more obvious because they're going to give themselves the longing, desire looks, you know.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting too, because even though, okay, yeah, so now we don't have the Hays Code. Yes, we can like say that this is a film about desire. It's like, All right, well, how many times are you going to hit the nail on the fucking head?
I mean, they hit it so much. Like, I don't understand why they had to give me her flashback of her having sex. I get it. You had to show me once. I mean, I don't need to see it again.
It's a 3-part miniseries, and you played back to it, like, how many times? I get it.
Every episode had, like, a callback.
And yeah, and it was just like, I know that this is like, you can go all the way now with Desire, and like, you really want to show what's going on between the two of them, but like, when is too much enough?
I agree with you. I think, yeah, this is where you, again, so remember, I had very high hopes. This is the BBC, mm-hmm. and I think the two properties that we've covered, they've actually handled very well. His Dark Materials, Dracula.
Yes.
You know, so I was very much just like, oh, I'm going to be excited. And I think the show gives you, it does give you kind of like amplifies those scenes. It makes them longer, kind of builds in the lore a little bit. But sometimes that was, I think that was a detriment for this. Yeah.
No, definitely. Because it, sometimes it almost was like, one, it just harps a little bit on uh-huh. like all these like kind of like themes and whatnot. And then sometimes there are moments where it's like, oh, that happened too fast.
Oh, yeah. I can say
and that wasn't impactful. That is 100% how I felt about the climax of the film. You know, when it's an hour and a half film, and of course it's certainly unfair to compare, but I will say when it's an hour and a half film, I guess maybe, and it was a very clear beginning, middle, and ending with the film, right?
Right.
They had time to build on that. I guess I expected them to be able to build on that a little bit more, and they built so much on Sister Ruth's losing herself.
Yeah, they really did.
But then they didn't really focus as much on her falling in love with Mr. Dean, right? So they fucked up there. Because in the original film, you know, she was ordering like her outfit and you were like watching her plot it. They had that whole scene where Clodagh walks in on her with the makeup, right?
Yeah, so I was angry that they did not have that scene.
They didn't
and
have
I was
that just scene.
Like, how do you... That is like such an important scene because for me, that is a scene where you see Sister Clodagh kind of struggling, where her realization is just like, oh my God, this could be me. And it's almost a moment where you see her kind of like click. It's just like, I chose to be a nun and I am sticking to this. Mm-hmm. That's why she takes out the Bible, right?
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, you see each of them like with their own weapon, a lipstick and a Bible. And you don't have that here. Instead, you kind of just see her kind of go a little boy crazy.
Yeah, well, you don't even really see, like, there's so many beautiful shots of Sister Ruth in the original, like spying on Clodagh.
Yes.
And Mr. Dean, and it's like wonderfully creepy, and there's like two of them in this miniseries,
which is a shame because it's a 3-part, each of them are an hour long, like mm-hmm. what that, again, it's just like they expanded on the wrong things.
They did. They spent too much time on Desire. And that uh-huh. they kind of like, there's a little bit more to it than just simply Desire. And that's right. kind of what this kind of lost.
Yeah. And so this is where, again, like I said this at the beginning of the podcast, I think this is a story about like horny nuns in a nunnery in India, right? That's a joke. But like the reason you can make that joke is because of the subtlety in there that if you want to read that, you can.
Yeah.
Here, you can't. Like in here, it's just, it's they really just like kind of lay it on thick.
They do, yeah.
And they don't leave room for interpretation.
Well, you know, and it's amazing too, because with a 3-part miniseries that focuses so deeply, at least on Sister Clodagh's desire, that they don't do it enough for Sister Ruth. It's just simply about her kind of like mental imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
So that when she decides to put on the clothes and run down to Mr. Dean and profess herself, it doesn't really land. You kind of don't even know why she's doing it, and you don't really get the motivation for it. Like, you don't, like, it doesn't hit home when she's like, oh, you know, like, you understand me and they're trying to keep you from me, because none of that has really been planted.
Well, I think it was also on the performance. I don't know, because they try to give you scenes where, like, you do have Sister Ruth and Mr. Dean. They actually have a lot more scenes where they interact together in this miniseries than they ever did in the movie. In the movie, that works to great effect, because when she professes her love to him, he's just like, I don't even know you.
Yeah.
Here, yeah. He's just, like, kind of more taken aback. It's just like, all right, well, this is wrong. And the reason for him it's wrong is because he is into Sister Clodagh, right? So it already messes up that kind of... It turns into a weird love triangle instead of, like, a man who's just, like... Just like, you know, not interested. I don't know. You can make the argument that Mr. Dean wanted to bang Sister Clodagh, but I don't think he was interested in her romantically.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And here, it's the opposite, right? Yeah, I think he wanted to have a physical relationship with her, but he also wanted to be with her. I think he, I think he did find himself falling in love with her.
No, in fact, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I would say the only one that I believed in terms of characterization, like, I liked the relationship that was going on, was Sister Briny and Mr. Dean, because she was so smitten with him, but, like, in a very innocent way that I was just like, I love this. And
yeah.
She played it to such a great effect, where she's like, oh, Mr. Dean. Hello, Mr. You know, she was so adorable.
Yeah, Sister Briny in this one was really good.
And I was so charmed, and I kind of wish it's just like, okay, you do know how to do, like, in terms of direction, you can direct your cast to do something that's, like, kind of fun, and you can, like, as an audience, kind of, like, sympathize.
Yeah.
They just went too much into the craziness with Ruth.
Yeah, well, it was also, it just didn't really understand, like, where she was coming from and why, like, in term, like, I guess she went down there because of Mr. Dean, but then when she comes up, you know, she did it because of how she felt about Clodagh and Mr. Dean's relationship, or she just wanted to take out everything she felt on Clodagh. Like, her motivation for coming back up, and she only came up within, like, a matter of seconds, by the way.
Okay,
there was
yeah.
no build-up there anyway. But I didn't understand her motivation.
It was such a weirdly edited sequence.
Yeah, and the whole film is, there was a little bit too much editing in the whole miniseries, if you ask me.
I don't know.
There was,
I can make the same argument, though, to the original.
Absolutely.
The original
not.
Has a lot of fast cuts. The original has a lot of fast cuts.
No. I'm sorry. There are times when they're just simply talking and it's like, shot on you for 5 seconds, shot
oh, no,
on
I,
you
yeah,
for 5 seconds.
I agree with you on this. On this one, true. But, like, I'm actually more. The original one also has a lot of, like, these fast cuts.
Yes. Well, in the climax, yes. The editing even, for that is.
No,
beautiful.
Like, for example, the scene after Sister Honey gives the castor oil. Right? Like, it's almost like an immediate jump cut to, like, Sister Ruth, like, jumping up and just, like, everyone's screaming, ah, and there's, like, this fast, like, you know, it's hectic. It's a hectic scene.
I guess I was just
I get it.
Distracted by the editing in this one and not, like, a good way, I'll say.
No, fair. I think that's fair. I think for me, the most jarring edits were coming in the ending. It was, like, the physical movements were just, like, cut. And then next thing you know, like, she's already at the bell, and then cut, like, she's at the top of the stairs, cut.
Yeah.
It's like, ah, I'm going to push you. And then it turns into a fight, which is also annoying because it you don't need that fight, I think. Right?
Yeah, no, you don't need the fight. I mean, like, there was the hug, and then she wanted to push her, and then there was the push off and all this stuff.
Seriously, you don't think you don't need the fight? Because they look like they've been wanting to fight for the longest time.
No, a sister. Oh, because, that's a good. All right.
Because Ruth rubs
fair
her
enough.
The wrong way. Is, okay. And I think the interesting thing. All right. Because what's the challenge here is, here is Sister Superior trying to make things the best and perfect and try to control everything. And Ruth is the uncontrollable element here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's another thing. It's a physical persona of the uncontrolled element that she finds herself in, or
yeah.
situation that she finds herself in. And so you have the struggle at the end with this. And if you want to play it even further, it's almost, you see the yin and the yang between them, and the ultimate of her deciding that she needs to not be in control is the moment that she's in battle.
Okay, I actually agree with you on that one. I think this one kind of did give Sister Ruth and Sister Clodagh, like, a more tangible reason to not like each other. The reason I don't know if it was effective in the actual physical fight is maybe because of how it was orchestrated, right? The first part is, like, you know, she shoves her off the thing, and then they're both, like, kind of falling. And then they both get up. Then it's followed by Sister Clodagh hugging Ruth almost as an act of forgiveness. Then it turns into another physical alteration, which ends with Sister Ruth backing up and then jumping, right?
Yeah.
Which then clouds that thing at the end, because then it should have been Sister Clodagh, I don't know, maybe going like the good son and, like, you know, shoving her?
No, the good son is not about shoving.
Well, she had to pick.
The good son is about choosing.
And okay.
All right.
Well, she'd be
about
choosing.
Choice. No, it's not about that. I mean, it's not you. The idea wouldn't be about killing. The idea wouldn't be about you need to kill that aspect of you, kill that nature. No, the idea is to take that nature upon yourself, and then with doing that act, you give it grace. It becomes whole. You become whole.
But then what happened? What does it mean that Ruth killed herself then? Because Ruth committed suicide. Ruth committed suicide in this movie.
Yeah.
In the first one, she falls by accident.
I think that was kind of like their way of giving that character a better kind of like understanding and an ending. You know, they understood in this piece that she had a mental instability and that she was ill. And I think they were trying to be kinder to her, honestly, by doing that.
I don't know if that is effective, because that's not a good message for mental health.
Oh, I 100% agree with you.
Yeah, I actually, I thought...
This whole episode is not a good message.
But I actually thought... Or to
women.
Well, I thought it was going to end when she gives her that hug, and I thought they were going to change the ending completely, which I would have been okay with if they go this route, where you're solidifying Sister Clota's devotion to the godly way. You know, it would change the ending completely. But I when she gave that hug and I thought the fight was over, I thought it was just like, oh, interesting. I don't know how I feel. I think I paused it. And I was just like, I don't know how I feel about this, right? I'm thinking about it, letting it sit. And then I pressed play again. It was just like, oh, wait, no, they're going right into it again.
Well, wait, so why does it give the wrong message?
Because if Sister Ruth makes an active choice to kill herself, right?
Yes.
I don't know. It's almost like glamorizing it.
No, I wouldn't say it's glamorizing.
You don't think so?
Yeah, I mean, be careful with this.
The look in her face. I mean, yeah, all of this would be assumption, first of all. But like at the same time, you know, like I think that's also more motivation to realize how then people should get help, right? It's not glamorizing it. It's actually showing it the sad truth of what could happen.
But
when
both of these movies
don't deal with and treating this stuff.
Oh, okay. I was about to say, because both of these movies are about untreated mental illness.
Yes, and
in fact, I would make the argument that these both movies are about people who don't treat mental illness, but instead like cope with it through religion.
Yeah, which kind of you could very well go that route, but
I don't know. You can, because it's you think about the time period.
Fair,
okay. So you think about the time period, and you think about how the stigma behind mental illness,
yeah,
right? And even how the treatment was approached. Right. And even how women with mental illness were, you know, how were they treated?
Like hysterical.
You know? Because it was like, oh, she's just a hysterical woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, all these like terms that you would use are, you know, so, yeah. And then there was an understanding, too, when it seems to be when you live within these religious communities, it's like God would heal or God will use this in some way. As a tool, this could be used as a tool to spread the word of God, right? It's just like, even when the priest, Sister Superior was telling the priest, the father, you know, you need to take her. Like, you need to take Ruth. And he's like, no, she is your challenge. She is your challenge. And before you can begin, like, he was like, he used that term, like, take the plank out of your eye before you're able to take the splinter. It's this whole thing of like, take the plank out of your eye before you could take the splinter out of your brother or your sister's eye. You know, like, get over yourself first before you can help somebody become a better person. So when she's challenged like that by the priest, of course, all these like this pious or this kind of like, you know, God will heal. God will take care of this kind of thing. But I also thought that that was a moment, too, where the situation or most of the responsibility was taken out of Sister Superior's hands and placed on the priest, because he made the final decision to keep Ruth in this position where she felt that Ruth needed help and that she had witnessed that Ruth really needed some help here. Sister Ruth.
Oh, so okay. So now you're putting the blame on the man.
No, I'm not putting. Stop.
I'm asking.
Stop.
This is.
It's not about men or women, it's about her kind of. It's because we talk about her being young, right, and that she's responsible for this community, right?
Yeah.
But here she was making a decision. Here, recognizing that she was saying in her own way, I can't handle this because she needs professional help. And then her superior says, no, you need to get over what you're feeling and take care of this situation. This is your test.
Interesting. I mean, I think that's a fair argument for this show.
Also be not taking her seriously because she's a woman, which is like, right. Not even me trying to be like, you know, like sexist. I think that is very much a case that was probably common back then.
I had to assume, especially in a church, right? Like the church has a hierarchy. Like the priests, you know. So, okay, that's fair.
I mean, both films recognize that the character has a mental illness, and both films view Sister Ruth as a tragedy. So it's like, I do disagree with your idea of glamorizing death.
No, maybe that was the wrong word. I just think it's just like, I feel like for me, is that maybe you're like not glamorizing death. I think it's just saying, it's just like, okay, well, this is the only way out almost, right?
Well, that's also part of the tragedy, is that the character thinks that way. Yeah. And in like, in her particular circumstances, you know, like, it would be said that she would think that way.
Yeah, which is true. I agree. Obviously, some stories of depression end this way. It just feels reductive for some reason. I don't know. It could have just been the direction of the show for me, where it just kind of falls flat, as Sister Ruth did.
But that's, and that's the thing. And that's why I think it's an effective tragedy, is because you kind of look at it and you're like, no, that's wrong. Mm. And it is wrong. And that's why it's so effective. So I don't know. I mean, personally, do I think it's more effective to have the Sister Ruth character realize her own issues at the last moments of her life and then kill herself? I mean, that is more so my own problem, is that she, like, that right there, is that she realizes that there's this moment that clicks and then she decides death.
Okay.
And I think that, I more think that she ends up just kind of playing the original story about that young girl, that young mother who kills herself.
Yeah.
Mm. So here's this kind of like her being haunted by this story, and she kind of like, it becomes part of the, I don't know, it becomes the kind of like the background of her mental breakdown, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe that's why, maybe I'm just thinking that maybe that's why the Mr. Dean scene seemed forced. Because it wasn't her story. It wasn't her story about a young girl falling in love and then having her heart broken. But she decided to make it her story by maybe going through the motions, but not truly being connected to the situation itself.
It could be. That's a good read, yeah. I mean, she definitely lets herself be haunted by this.
And then
princess.
At the end, it's the process of her tragically kind of fulfilling the ending of someone else's story by her jumping.
Interesting. Well, then do you lean towards the belief that like she was possessed, as like they were kind of toying around here a little bit?
Yeah, I think that they want you to think that to some level there is like a haunting going on, whether it is herself that's haunting her or this ghost. Like, I strongly do believe that they want you to think in terms of like otherworldly presence happening. Or at least assisting. Which is why for me it kind of also didn't hit as well. Just because I think they were trying to like make it more so like, oh, it's up to you, and it's kind of like giving you more questions than answers, where I think an actual answer for me would have kind of been better, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, I see what you mean.
What about for you?
I don't know, because I don't subscribe to the idea that she was possessed. I actually do subscribe more to the idea of just mental instability. But
even though she was the only one who like could say the truth about anyone. In this film, like she was less crazy as much as like she was telling the truth, you know, like she said the truth about Sister Honey and then the comment she made about Sister Bryony.
She's very unchained and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the other sister who could tell the truth though was Sister Adora, because Sister Adora called
Adele,
sister.
Well, that was a great scene where she was like,
I like that scene.
And that, like, she was like, you should have consulted with us. Why did you consult with Mr. Dean? Do you like
him? Right? Because you see Kanshi being whipped by the general's nephew. And, you know, she seeks the comfort not from her own sisterhood. She seeks it in Mr. Dean. And Sister Adora, she called that shit out. She was just like, You let this happen under your own watch because you have your own feelings for him. And some people would say she read her to filth.
I would say so too. And you know what's also interesting, and this is one thing I did like about this, is that a couple moments later, Ruth makes her like declarations that Bryony is probably a lesbian. Mm-hmm. In that scene, do you remember how like upset she gets? Like, how can you say that? And she like throws her stuff. And that scene, I almost feel like it was implied that maybe this is true about Bryony and that she herself has feelings for Clota.
Oh, interesting.
Getting defensive for her.
I now see that a little differently. And I'm not...
I mean, it's easy for me to make that read.
Yeah. But I don't know, because I was seeing Sobriety as being so smitten with Mr. Dean.
No, I thought of them as being pals.
Interesting. I thought it was more like smitten, like he's so adorable, he's so cute, like, oh my God.
Kind of. Well, she's also the only one who seems to not be attracted to him in any way.
That's true. Oh, that's fair. That's a good point. Yeah. Okay.
But so that was just like a cute little backstory that
if that's okay. Maybe yeah. You're taking that from the book a little bit. Do you
maybe?
Think Sister
I'm
Briny,
not sure.
Is that why Sister Briny was the strongest one in the original one?
Yeah, probably. Mm. It seems like it was there and then maybe they expanded upon it.
Possibly. I can't say we didn't read the book.
But yeah.
Interesting.
But they did yeah. They did fix a lot of things in this one in terms of like casting. It was more appropriately casted.
Yeah.
And Sister Philippa was played by a black woman, which I thought was really nice.
Of course, Sister Philippa also gets shipped off in the second
Yeah. Well, yeah, leave the crazy stuff for the white people. But like, I also thought it was kind of nice that even though it wasn't 100% realistic, like, you know, it didn't bother me.
Well, the Sister Philippa would be black?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think, Eddie, is that a thing, right? Even, do you think it would have been a thing back then? Like having...
Black people?
Having black people
in colonial India?
Yeah, well, I guess I can't. I don't know the politics of colonial India, but would they?
Well, as angelic nuns, yes.
Yeah, would they take like someone from another country and stuff and bring them to these countries? Is that how it would work?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Like, if let's say she's from the from an African nation or from the Caribbean, right? And they bring her and she becomes nun.
Yeah, if the order had spread out and the order of Saint Mary. Right? Was the order that...
I thought it was Saint Faith.
No, Saint Faith.
No, that was the name of the convent.
Oh,
the name
okay.
of the convent was called Saint Faith.
Oh.
But she I forgot.
The Sisters of Saint Mary.
Yeah.
I mean, if they would branch up. But okay, so... But we're making assumptions here. We don't know.
We don't know.
Yeah, we're not sure.
She could have been...
Well, she had an accent. She had an accent.
But she could have been a citizen from England at some point.
I suppose it's true.
You know,
yeah.
History tells us that it's probably not likely, but whether or not it was a nice little thing, I didn't mind it.
Oh, that's so interesting. I actually didn't think much of that because I think religion, like the, I don't know, maybe this just might be from my time in like grammar school, going to private school and stuff. But like I was led to believe that like racism, while prevalent everywhere, it was when it comes to like actually like priesthood and nunneries and stuff, like maybe less so there because okay, so then that was just misguided beliefs that were taught to me at grammar school. So there was racism and stuff back there.
You're
so.
Open. You have
huh
you have systematic uh-huh. and you have ways of like making people feel bad.
Okay, got it. Point taken. So, all right. So, yeah. So, maybe Sister Philippa wouldn't have been. Maybe that seemed a little incredulous. But I thought it was a nice touch. I agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Is there anything else that you enjoyed about this new one?
I genuinely did enjoy the camera work. And I think I enjoyed the set design and stuff. I think it was. And I think some sequences work. I kind of wish there were. They had just gone the full haunting route and go full supernatural. Just go full supernatural. Like, give me a new version of this story that is so far removed from the original one that I can like appreciate it.
Yeah, it's like right? It almost like had its foot halfway through the door, and it's like you're either come in or get the fuck out.
Right, and it's because it's a hard. The truth is, like, this is a hard act to follow. Like, Black Narcissus is such a good movie,
100%.
That you're watching this one and stuff. And this is one of the reasons why I genuinely watch. I do this podcast. Like, I go backwards. Mm-hmm. I watch like the new stuff first and then go back because a lot of times the original one is so much more superior to the new one that it's just like if I had seen this one first, I would have been like, okay, this is fine. And you watch Black Narcissus, I'd be like, oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. You know, that disappointment is like kind of lessened a little.
Yeah, stuff, but yeah, I see that.
What I mean, this begs the question and stuff, and I think I know the answer, but do you think this remake was needed.
Yeah, so for me, it's just gonna have to be no. I mean, I enjoyed seeing it, and the idea of it was really exciting because I love the film, and I feel like they were trying to give it a feminist twist and give it, you know, like this kind of update that we were all looking for. And I thought it delivered, especially with on the aspect, and it probably did, of Clodagh and Mr. Dean. But then it just got a little caught up in doing other stuff and trying to maybe give Ruth, you know, like a more understanding that her character didn't get in the first one and other aspects, that it kind of just became something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it focused so heavily on desire that the other things that were kind of introduced that they were trying to either fix or to add, it didn't evolve the text, it didn't evolve the story, and it did not involve the characters. It actually, in Ruth's case, got things a little muddled for me.
Okay.
So you didn't really add much to it. In some ways, you kind of just like divided it up, and now it's just in a bunch of, it's in like a bunch of little chunks, and I don't know what to do with it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
So in that case, it didn't have to do that. And when you live in the shadow of, you know, such a, like a film that stays with you, you know, it's such a visually impactful film, I guess it's just kind of like, I wish they didn't set themselves up for failure, because I feel like in some ways I was bound to say, no, this was not needed. It didn't give me anything. What about you?
It didn't. Yeah, I agree with you. It didn't give you anything new. I would say this was most certainly not needed. However, I will say this. If only for people, oh, I don't know. I don't, this, you know, that's just me being wishful thinking here. What I was going to say is just like, hopefully maybe people want to check out now the original one.
Oh gosh. I really, really hope so.
I do too, but I can't, I don't know. I just feel like it just wasn't needed. And the reason I would say it's just not needed is because if you watch this, you would think it's just like, oh, I don't know if I need, do I want to revisit the story again, right? They kind of made the story boring. So here's my one qualm about this. It's like the first movie, the original, moves at a lightning pace. It's an hour, 40 minutes, and it's a very tight story.
Yeah.
They condense a lot of time in that hour and 40 minutes. This one, they spread out the story into 3 hours, and I was struggling to finish some episodes, right? Because it was just boring.
And it's always like the way that they did it, it's like something's always around the corner, and they love to build up all the suspense and like with the music and the way things were shot, and it just didn't deliver.
Right.
It was like there was never any payoff to all the suspense.
I wish they had done a different genre with this and kind of just really either deliver some spooks or
made it
something
sadder,
new.
You know, make it more like heartbreaking. Cause in this case, you know, it was like all this suspense for what, especially when the thing you're focusing mainly on is this love that's happening between Clodagh and Dean. Like you could have made me fucking cry if you wanted to, but you didn't.
I agree. You could have. Cause it's not to like, this isn't on their, they had great chemistry. They had great chemistry. I think they were good performances. I just think overall it was just like kind of like, I don't know. I didn't need this.
No.
I didn't need this.
And I don't even think it really got viewers' attentions. You know, like it started off well with like 0.44 million views. And then it went down by the third one to 0.31. So, but it's not, you know, it seems like it lost people.
Yeah, you know, what can I say? This was a miss from the BBC. Yeah. I had high hopes here.
But nice try.
Yes, nice try. Sure.
Thanks for letting us make this episode.
Yes. Do you want to do a quick lightning round?
Yeah, sure.
Super quick.
Lay one at me.
Lightning round.
Let's start with Sister Philippa, the gardener.
Sister Philippa.
100% the original, just because I feel like there was something so sad about her, like that scene where she's just kind of staring off at the distance, and then Clodagh comes up to her and she's like, yo, the bell. And she's like, oh my God. Yeah. Like, I don't even know where it was. And you see the sadness in her face. I really think the original. Yeah.
I'm going to go with the new Sister Philippa because I kept confusing the original Sister Philippa with Sister Briny. I couldn't tell them apart.
Okay. All right. Sister Briny. Yeah.
I'm going to go with the new Sister Bryony.
Me too.
The new Sister Bryony really won me over. I think she made this her own character. Yeah. She had fun with it. Yeah. And I, as a result, that's like one of the few fresh, you know, breaths of air that I was getting when I was watching this.
No, 100%. The read that I got on it really made that character for me. So
adds a more interesting read too. It makes her a little more interesting of a character for sure.
For sure. What about Sister Honey?
They're both forgettable.
Yeah, they're kind of like the fifth in the chain of commands. Yeah, but the new girl's eyes were just so like breathtaking. But I'm gonna have to go with the original just because I remember her a little bit more.
All right, that's fair. Anju. Angu?
Oh, whew. I guess. Ugh. I mean, what a freaking performance in the original.
Yeah.
But I did like this new one.
Okay, fair. I am gonna go with the original on this one. That performance is so over the top.
It's so over the top.
So wild and so crazy. Like when she's whipping Ganshi.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, it's great. Yeah. So
I will say the original young general, Dilip Rai, played by Sabu, who I love. I love Sabu. I'm going to go with Sabu. Him.
Yeah, yeah. He was good. Let's start going to some of the bigger characters. So let's go off with Mr. Dean. New Mr. Dean or original Mr. Dean?
I'm going to go with the original. He was just... Like when he came in and he started singing, "Oh Come All Ye Faithful" in the original.
Oh, he had a great voice.
Great voice, and that outfit with that fur coat, and him riding that mule. And he's just such a brute. Like he seems like the kind of guy who lives in isolation by choice in the Himalayas.
I agree with you. Original Mr. Dean for sure. However, it's not. It's not like a wide margin between Mr. Dean and the new Mr. Dean. I think the new Mr. Dean, I actually liked the new Mr. Dean. By the end of the series, I was very much smitten by him as I felt Bryony was.
Bryony,
yeah.
All right, so I want to go Clodagh first.
Oh, you want to go Clodagh first? All right. Sister Clodagh for me would be Deborah Kerr.
By a wide margin, Deborah Kerr.
Yeah. Like, it's not even a contest. It's like Deborah Kerr just acted circles around about Gemma. And it's crazy when she had less time to work with.
Yeah, you know? Seriously. And it's not like Gemma's screen time. Fault, really.
No, it's not. But it's a hard act to follow.
Seriously.
Just like, sorry, girl.
And speak of hard act to follow, Sister Ruth.
I want to go also with the original
Kathleen Byron. And I also have to, you know, I'm going to have to give it to like the cinematographer with Jack Cardiff and just the way he shot her, the way that the makeup artist and everyone like that all impacted that absolutely wonderful performance that was done by Kathleen Byron, the original.
Yeah. She makes Crazy look so good in this movie.
Yeah, seriously.
She really, truly does.
Guys, please watch Black Narcissus.
Yeah, if you could find it anywhere, rent it. It's worth it. It's so good.
It's so worth it.
It holds up so much.
Yeah. And if you end up watching it, or if you saw this new one, you know, reach out to us and share your opinion. Let them know where they can do that, Rolando.
You can email us. Our email is remakesrebootsrevivals@gmail.com. You could also find us on Facebook.com/remakesrebootsrevivals. We're on Instagram @remakesrebootsrevivals. And we are, I'm also on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is remakespodcast. Check us out, hit us up. And also, guys, leave us ratings and reviews on iTunes. And if you do, send us a DM so that way we could like highlight you, because we have been starting a campaign where we're showing off some of these great reviews we've been getting. So if you've left us a review and you want us to give you a shout out, let us know. Slide into our DM, guys.
Yeah, hit us up.
And that is it this faithful journey into the Himalayas.
Yeah.
Himalayas?
Are we in the Himalayas? Himalayas, yeah. It's in the Himalayas, yeah. It's near Darjeeling, so.
So, yeah, that's it.
So crazy. It just makes me want to travel. I'm so tired of being home.
Become a nun.
I want to be stuck up there in Mopu and lose my mind.
I mean.
I'd rather lose my mind staring at that than, you know, outside of my apartment window.
Just put a painting on your window.
Yeah, I'll buy one of those Jack Cardiff paintings.
Yeah, and put it there. Blow it up and put it out there being like, it's just like, there we go. I'm in the Himalayas today.
I feel like losing my mind. All right, well, until next time.
Stay original.